This is Harv Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast, and I recently decided to give Sterling Soap Company's Ground Breakfast Blend coffee a try. While brewing, the aroma was inviting, and the taste? Lightly sweet and delicious, as the texture of this amazing coffee was sweet and smooth, as I experienced a coffee with a velvety texture, almost creamy. Sterling's breakfast blend is light but in no way weak, with a high quality taste and smell. My wife and I are now hooked on Sterling Soap coffee, and you should be too. Check out their coffees and other products at sterlingsoap.com. That's S-T-I-R-L-I-N-G soap.com.
In February 1936, a hotel lobby in Chicago, two men standing face to face. One is George Halas, owner and coach of the Chicago Bears, already a two-time NFL champion. The other is Jay Berwanger, halfback from the University of Chicago, winner of the very first Heisman and the most celebrated college football player in America. Halas has just acquired Berwanger's rights from the Philadelphia Eagles, and he's ready to make him a Bear. He asks the young man for what he wants. Berwanger looks at him and says, $25,000, 2 years, a no-cut contract. Halas, who paid his own Hall of Fame fullback, Bronco Nagurski, less than $3,000 a year, stares back at him. The two men shake hands, say goodbye, and Jay Berwanger, the first player ever selected in an NFL draft, walks out of that hotel lobby and never plays a single down of professional football. This is a story of the NFL draft, an idea born from a bidding war, a system designed to save struggling league, and the man who looked at professional football and said, no thanks. The NFL did not begin as a grand vision for competitive balance. It began because one man, Burt Bell, owner of the Philadelphia Eagles, got humiliated trying to sign a fullback from Minnesota named Stan Kostka. Now, Stan Kostka was a 6 foot, 225 round battering ram. The Minneapolis Star called him the snorting Stan and a blasting bull. Now, Kirk Shaughnessy, the legendary coach at the University of Chicago at the time, said of him, I doubt whether any fullback ever hit harder than he could in the open field. And he was one of the few men who could simply run through a tackle. In 1935, after his final college season, Kostka became the most sought after professional prospect in the country. Every team in the league wanted him. And the Bears, the Packers, the Giants, the Dodgers, the Pirates, and Burt Bell's Philadelphia Eagles. Bell was desperate. He had purchased the Philadelphia Eagles in 1933. It was a franchise born from the ashes of the bankrupt Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, established as a replacement team. And in their first three seasons, the Eagles had finished with records of 3-5-1, then 4-7. And then in 1935, they'd hit rock bottom at 2-9, and they were bleeding money, losing games. So Bell flew to Minneapolis, sat down with Kostka in a hotel room, and asked him what other teams had offered. Kostka had told him the top bid was $3,500. Now Bell made his move. I'll give you $4,000, he said. Now Kostka hesitated and said $5,000. Still hesitating, $6,000. Sign now and I can go home. Now Kostka didn't sign, and Bell flew back to Philadelphia empty-handed. And a few days later, Kostka inked a contract with the Brooklyn Dodgers for $5,000 plus a $500 signing bonus, making him at the time the highest paid rookie in professional football history. Bronco Nagurski, the most feared player in the league, was making roughly $3,000 a year. Later, Kostka admitted exactly what he had done. In his own words, he said, I was the instigator of the draft. Every club in the league contacted me. A team would send me a wire and say they're going to give me $3,500. I'd send them a wire back and say, Green Bay or the Bears, they said they'd give me $4,000, and I kept that up. A man had run an auction on himself, and the owners had been powerless to stop him. And on the flight home to Minneapolis, Burt Bell made a decision. He would later say, I made up my mind that this league would never survive unless we had some system whereby each team had even a chance to bid on a talent against the other. He had an idea. And on May 19th, 1935, at the Fort Pitt Hotel in Pittsburgh, he presented it to the other owners. The proposal was simple, and it carried Bell's name with it, with a second from George Preston Marshall, owner of the Boston Redskins at the time. Now, every year, the teams would select college players in reverse order of the previous year's standings. The worst team would pick first, the champion would pick last. And once a team selected a player, no other team could negotiate with that same player. The bidding wars would end. And the vote was unanimous. Even George Halas, who Chicago Bears would sacrifice the most under his system. They had won back-to-back championships in 32 and 33 and finished 23-2-1 over the 1933 and 34 seasons. He voted yes. Halas understood something that the others were slower to grasp. A league is only as strong as its weakest franchise. And if the Eagles and the Pirates kept hemorrhaging money, there would be no league left for the Bears to dominate. Now, Jay Berwanger grew up in Dubuque, Iowa, the son of the blacksmith, and he arrived at the University of Chicago in 1932 on a $300 a year tuition scholarship. Iowa, Michigan, Minnesota, and Purdue had all recruited him more aggressively, but Chicago offered the smallest package, but he chose them anyway. Now, in an era before two-platoon football, before players specialized on offense or defense, Berwanger did everything. He called the plays. He ran the ball. He threw it. He punted. He returned punts. He returned kickoffs, extra points, and he played linebacker on defense. The Chicago Tribune called him the one-man team. Other writers called him the Flying Dutchman, an heir since his ancestry was German, not Dutch. And the man in an iron mask because he wore a custom face guard to protect his twice-broken nose. Now, here are his career numbers calculated decades later and incomplete game-by-game records. 1,839 yards rushing on 439 carries, an average of 4.2 yards per rush, 22 rushing touchdowns, 50 completions on 146 pass attempts for 921 yards, and 20 extra points kicked. And on special teams, 46.3-yard average on 34 kickoffs and a 38-yard average on his 233 punts. Now, in 1934, during a game against Michigan, the future president of the United States, Gerald Ford, then a Wolverines linebacker, attempted to tackle him. Decades later, Ford said, "When I tackled Jay in the second quarter, I ended up with a bloody cut, and I still have the scar to prove it." Now, Berwanger remains the only Heisman Trophy winner ever to be tackled by a future president. In 1935, Berwanger received a telegram from the Downtown Athletic Club in Manhattan. He had been awarded a new trophy, the Downtown Athletic Club Trophy, for being, in the club's words, the most valuable player east of the Mississippi, and the telegram included a trip for two to New York. Now, that trophy would later be renamed the following year, and after the club's athletic director, a man named John W. Heisman. Now, by the time the draft rolled around in February 1936, Berwanger was not thinking about professional football. He was thinking about the Olympics. He was a track star aiming for the decathlon, and he was thinking about his business degree. The NFL in 1936 was not a dream destination. It was a side hustle. Berwanger told the Associated Press, "For the time being, I am mainly interested in finishing my courses at Chicago, graduating next June, and then trying to get a place on the Olympic team." He didn't make the Olympic team, but he was about to make history anyway on a February afternoon in a Philadelphia ballroom. And we'll get to what happened then right after this message.
Think you know your football history? It's time to put your pads on with the Pigskin Trivia Drive. Choose your play, go for a run, short pass, or risk it all with a long pass. Answer fast to rack up the yardage and reach the yellow line for a first down and earn an audible to wipe away those wrong answers. But watch out, that play clock has gotcha. We got 25 seconds before the penalty hits. Score as many touchdowns as you can in 5 minutes and claim your spot on the global leaderboard. Pigskin Trivia Drive, where your football IQ is the MVP. Play now at pigskindispatch.com.
We're glad you're back. We're taking you back to 1936, February 8th. We are in a Philadelphia ballroom where the first NFL draft is taking place. The Ritz-Carlton Hotel, 9 teams, 9 rounds, and 81 players selected. There were no television cameras. There was no draft analyst, no green room, and most of the owners worked from lists of players that they had compiled from newspaper clippings and college media guides. Some names were misspelled. Some players were selected who had already decided not to play pro football, and the entire affair was conducted in near obscurity. Now, the Philadelphia Eagles picking first selected Jay Berwanger, halfback, University of Chicago, Heisman Trophy winner. But Bell's Eagles knew they could not afford to sign him. The team was broke. So they traded Berwanger's rights to the Chicago Bears, the richest, most successful franchise in the league, owned by a man who had proven that he would pay for talent. What happened next passed into legend. Now, according to the Pro Football Hall of Fame and Berwanger's own account, Halas had offered him a contract worth $13,500, a significant sum for that era, far more than most NFL players earned. But Berwanger, who had studied business at Chicago and understood exactly what the first Heisman winner's name was worth, made a counteroffer. He said, quote, I said 25,000 for 2 years and a no-cut contract. Berwanger told the New York Times decades later. We shook hands, said goodbye, and he and I have been good friends ever since. Now, Halas reached his limit at 13,500, and Berwanger held at 15,000, roughly $260,000 today. The gap was $1,500, and neither man blinked. George Halas, who had built a dynasty on toughness and discipline, could not bring himself to pay a rookie more than four times what he was paying Bronco Nagurski. And Jay Berwanger, a 22-year-old with a business degree and a clear sense of his own worth, could not bring himself to accept less. So Jay Berwanger did something that's incomprehensible to us modern people in the NFL, in the modern NFL. A league where the number one pick in the 2025 draft signed a four-year contract worth more than $41 million a year. Berwanger walked away. He took a job as a foam rubber salesman. Now, he was not alone, as Bill Shakespeare, the Notre Dame back selected in the third round overall by the Pittsburgh Pirates, also said no. Paul Bear Bryant, drafted in the fourth round by the Brooklyn Dodgers, declined professional football to pursue coaching. Probably a good idea that he did that, and probably good for football. Eddie Eldredge of St. Mary's, a third-round pick of the Chicago Cardinals, also walked away. Four All-Americans in the first four rounds. The very first NFL draft looked at professional football, and the same thing, thank you, but no. But Berwanger was the first, and that's what mattered. The 1936 draft was, by modern standards, a failure. Of the 81 players selected, fewer than half ever played a down in the NFL. The very first pick never suited up. And the very idea that professional teams could compel college stars to play for them, the core conception of the draft, was not yet a reality. But the framework held, the principle that the worst teams get the first chance at the best players survived its first test and every test since. The draft that Bell created over the coming decades became the single most important engine of the competitive balance of American professional sports. Yes, I said all American professional sports. Now, here's what Bell understood in 1935 that most sports executives did not. A league is a partnership. If the Green Bay, the smallest market in professional sports, cannot compete with the New Yorks and the Chicagos of the league, the entire enterprise will eventually collapse. The draft was not a charity. It was self-preservation. Now, Bell would go on to become the NFL commissioner in 1946, and he served that role until his death in 1959. The man who chased Stan Kostka in Minneapolis hotel room and who proposed the draft at the Fort Pitt Hotel, who owned a team that finished 2-9 and earned the first pick in history. Well, that man became one of the architects of professional football as we know it now. The Burt Bell Award, given annually to the NFL's best player of the year, is named for him, and his bust sits in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. As for Jay Berwanger, well, he never regretted his decision. He built a successful manufacturing business, Jay Berwanger Incorporated, producing plastic and sponge rubber strips for car doors, trunks, and farm machinery. He wrote a sports column for the Chicago Daily News, and he refereed college football games. He served as a Navy flight instructor during World War II, teaching pilots to fly. And later, he said that those flights were more terrifying than anything that he had experienced in the war. In 1954, he was inducted into College Fame Football Hall of Fame's inauguration, and his Heisman Trophy spent decades in a glass case at the University of Chicago. His son, Collier, later said of him, "My dad always said, football is what I did, but it's not who I am." Jay Berwanger died on June 26, 2002, at the age of 88. He was the only man in history to be the first Heisman Trophy, the first NFL draft pick, and a phone rubber salesman. All in the same remarkable life. And when the commissioner steps up to the podium on draft night each April or May, the flashbulbs popping, the fans roaring, and the young men in tailored suits waiting for their names to be called, what they are participating in began in a hotel ballroom in Philadelphia in 1936. A room full of men working from newspaper clippings, a draft board with names spelled wrong, and a first pick at professional football that said, "I'm worth more than you think." The draft was born in that room, and it has never stopped teaching the same lesson. Jay Berwanger taught George Halas in a Chicago hotel lobby, talent knows its value. And the league just spent the next 99 years learning to pay for it. Now, next time on the Gridiron Timeline that we cover on PigskinDispatch.com, we'll go to the year 1969. And what a year of change that was. A year of surprises. A year of AFL and NFL merging. A year when the AFL got to look the NFL eye to eye and proved its worth. Helped the merger, helped everything, and a lot of great college football as well. We'll have that and more coming up. But join us each day on PigskinDispatch.com and that great Pigskin Dispatch timeline. Till next time, everybody, have a great Gridiron Day.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude. And I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you got to do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.